This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 204 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, another week has gone by. We had a good show last week. Hopefully this one will be as good, but they have to just listen to us, don't they?
That's right. No guests this episode, but we've got some great news stories.
We do. Our topics tonight run from UK regs, crash test drones, Thor, but not the Marvel one, S-A-G-I-T-T-A, and sparks falling from the sky, as well as Max's new favorite video of the week.
Yes.
So I guess we should get started. What do you think?
Let's get started.
Well, our first story comes from www.gov.uk. Drones to be registered and users to sit safety tests under new government rules. Well, looks like the UK is catching up with the rest of the world and going to start registering their drones.
Drone registration is coming, as is a drone safety awareness test. Now, this doesn't apply to the smallest drones, does it, David?
No, it's 250 grams over. And 250 grams, that's I was trying to figure out today when we were talking about this what a 250 gram drone is, but basically it's your amateur, you know, small quadcopter, I guess, right?
Yeah, pretty small. It's 8.8 ounces, I guess, if you convert 250 grams. So it's half a pound. There's your 0.55 pounds.
I like this. They'll be able to register online or with an app.
That's right.
They're making it easy on the people. And they also, part of this new regulation is an expansive geofencing. I guess we're going down that route because people are flying where they're not supposed to. So we're going to start making sure they can't, right?
Well, we're going to try, or manufacturers are trying. Geofencing, of course, is implemented in software, and any software practically can be defeated if you are clever enough, and we know that people have defeated the geofencing built into some drones. So, this is kind of a back and forth. One side takes a step forward, the other side has to respond, and I imagine it's kind of a battle you can't win. It would be effective, I guess, amongst those who are not sufficiently skilled or motivated to try to defeat it. So maybe geofencing is something that really would be effective for the majority of drone operators, but I'm just speculating. This report comes on the heels of another report. You know, one of the things, David, that we've, kind of lamented about is the lack of hardcore data when it comes to the effects of drones striking aircraft, right? We have some reports. Many of them have turned out to not be drone strikes, but we don't have a lot of, much at all of any hard evidence, any good studies about the effects of drones hitting aircraft. And the UK has been active in that regard too. And we have a new report.
We do. And the reason why Max laments this about so much is because in his previous career, he used to like watching frozen turkeys being shot into jet engines. What's the drone equivalent? And we sort of got that. This is another government.uk. It's a summary report from their Department for Transportation, and BALPA, which is the British Airline Pilots Association and the Military Aviation Authority. Drones weighing 400 grams could damage the windscreens of helicopters in particular. And I guess that statement's probably correct, because I think the first drone strike probably will be a helicopter, because, you know, a helicopter is flying more in the environment where a drone would be flying, the same altitudes, etc. So, I mean, that's kind of important. Whereas, you know, the jetliners, we're always talking about final approaches or around airports.
Right. Yes. Drones and helicopters probably operate in greater proximity than drones and airliners in general. But this study, and we'll have a link in the show notes to the PDF of the report. It's titled Small Remotely Piloted Aircraft Systems or Drones Mid-Air Collisions Study. And there is one kind of caveat here that I picked up on, which is that this was done using laboratory collision testing and computer modeling. So I didn't delve too deeply into exactly the test methodology, but again, you know, laboratory controlled environments, which may represent real world situations to a greater or lesser degree. Not sure. But what they wanted to do is they wanted to find out what's the lowest speed, the lowest collision speed where you could result in critical damage to aircraft components. And critical damage was defined in this study, to mean, as they say, major structural damage of the aircraft component or penetration of drone through the windscreen into the cockpit. And they have some kind of interesting results. They found that helicopter windscreens come in bird strike certified and non-bird strike certified versions. And they found that the non-bird strike certified helicopter windscreens had really limited resilience to the impact of drones, even well below normal cruise speeds. They also note that the non-bird strike certified helicopter windscreen results, they're also applicable to general aviation airplanes, which also don't have bird strike certified requirements. But they did find that helicopter tail rotors are particularly vulnerable to the impact of drones. And the modeling, again, here we go, modeling, is showing that blade failures from impacts with the smaller of the drones that they tested. So that seems to be a particularly vulnerable area. But they also looked at airline windscreens.
They're automatically bird strike capable. So there's a much better result out of that. However, it was found that damage did occur at high but realistic impacts with the 1.0 kilogram class drone components. However, critical damage did incur to the airliner windscreens at high but realistic impact screens with the 4 kilogram class drone components used in the study.
The lighter drones didn't
bounced off,
I guess. But with the 4 kilogram class, they did find some significant, or what they called, critical damage.
But, you know, it's interesting, Max, that they focused on, with the airliners, they focused on just impact to the cockpit. We've always talked about, and maybe that's because of your former career, but we've always talked about what happens when an engine gets sucked in. One gets sucked into an engine. What does that do? And I get the feeling that that wasn't modeled at all. So much for our turkey going into our engine.
Seems to. Another really interesting conclusion is that in some cases, the way the drone was constructed played a greater role in the impact than the weight of the drone. So, for example, they saw that some of the lighter drones that had exposed metal motors actually caused more damage than heavier drones that had plastic coverings around the motors. So I thought that was particularly interesting. It's not just the weight of the drone, but the way it's constructed can really affect the amount of damage that the drone causes when striking at least windscreens. So, yeah, very, very interesting. This is, so far as I know, the most comprehensive test of this type that's taken place. If any of you listening are aware of any additional tests, real-world tests or laboratory-based or simulation-based tests, I'd be interested in hearing from you.
It's bizarre, Max. It's twice this week we've talked about electronic simulated tests for various things. We were talking about this on Monday about seat pitches and evacuations out of airplanes without real-world data. And this week, we're talking about it here. It's the maybe we rely a little too much on computers. We need to go back to good old-fashioned launching turkeys into engines.
Yeah, do it in meat space.
Do it the old-fashioned way.
Right.
Or have Thor throw his hammer through the engine.
There we go.
How's that for a transition?
That's a great transition. This turned out to be a really interesting story because it related back to a conversation we had with a guest way back in episode 48. That was kind of cool. So what are we looking at here, David?
Thor hybrid UAV. This is from UAV Expert News. The transformable hovering rotorcraft from a team at Singapore University of Technology and Design. And of course, everything has to be in an acronym. So the Thor is based on the single blade monocopter concept from 1913, or Maple Seed, or Robo Seed, one of our favorite things that we discovered at Pilot Day or Innovations of Flight.
That's right. At the National Air and Space Museum, we talked with Evan Ulrich, who had developed this Robo Seed. Monocopters are kind of an interesting concept. When they first tried it in 1913, 14, and 15, it didn't work out too well. A monocopter being a device that has a wing or a blade that rotates, but only one. And so that causes obvious issues. I think the original had the difficulty of the entire vehicle spinning, as opposed to what happens with a helicopter, where you've got two or more blades, and the helicopter body itself doesn't turn. But Evan had developed this Robo Seed, a little device that flew successfully. And over here at Singapore, we see that these students with this Thor prototype. Now, this is actually a double wing or double blade device. So it's similar in some ways to the monocopter, but I guess technically it's not. But this thing, with its two opposing wings, it actually spins and can take off and land vertically, but then when it's up hovering, the wings, which are mounted at right angles, they lock, and it turns into a fixed wing craft. It's really kind of a fascinating idea.
It's a tilt wing, but it's a tilt wing, but different. What I was trying to figure out was, does only one of the wings tilt, not both wings tilt. One of them does to go into the monocopter mode. But then when the other one converts, when it goes forward, it drops the one. So it's a tilt wing where we're used to seeing a tilt wing have engines mounted on the end of it, and the wing moves up and down. Or down for forward flight and up for hovering. This is only one half of it moves. So it's interesting. We've got a video of the week because I'm doing a poor job describing how it flies. But so I would recommend you do it and look at Thor, and it's pretty neat. And of course, we'll have the interview with Evan, a link to in our show notes to UAV 048. Wow, that was a long time ago.
I tried to see if there are any more recent developments with the Robo Seed. But I wasn't able to find any, so maybe we'll reach out to Evan if he's not listening and see if we can update our coverage of the RoboSeed. But for the time being, we have Thor, and like David says, take a look at the show notes at the UAVDigest.com/204, and you'll be able to watch a little video of the Thor flying.
And the next one is, we've gone from hammers to bows or arrows. Successful yes. First flight for the UAV demonstrator, the Sagitta. And this is from Airbus.com. They have flown their Sagitta UAV jet powered by two turbines, fixed wing, 25% scale. Kind of a neat jet UAS. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, it's got a 3-meter wingspan, 3 meters in length. This has been developed not just by Airbus. They've been working this project in cooperation with a number of industry and academic partners. This thing has a carbon fiber body. They say it's fairly stealthy. And I think that really they're envisioning military applications for this, wouldn't you say, David?
Oh, yeah. This is definitely a military piece of hardware. What's interesting about it is it's, as they say, quote, an electronic flying device that's controlled by electromechanical actuators instead of hydraulic components. So it's interesting. We're going back to radio-controlled airplanes. What do you think, Max? You know, your radio-controlled servo is a electromechanical actuator. It's a servo is, I mean, it's not the, pretty straightforward. You run it, the motor turns and the flap drops. So it's, we're back to radio controlled airplanes, sort of.
Airbus, of course, has been involved in this arena, if you will, for some time. And I think that Airbus is, you know, looking ahead in the future, and they see an unmanned aircraft future. So they intend to be players in that industry. So this is a start.
Could that be because they reduced the total of A380s again from production?
Oh, yeah, but they're making a lot of A320 class aircraft. It kind of makes up for it. But yeah, I think that's a good strategic move for Airbus. We have another move.
We do. And I hesitate to say this because it's kind of interesting, but could DJI have actually screwed up, and maybe the perfection that they've come to be known for is sort of not happening? Because this came from TheVerge.com. Some DJI Spark drones are falling from the sky, and that's to be expected. They have the Spark, and they keep suddenly losing power in mid-flight.
Yeah, and this comes from a number of people complaining about this issue, this problem, in some of the forums and so forth that are frequented by DJI flyers or, you know, other drone forums. People were starting to wonder, well, what's going on here? DJI has issued a statement. They say they're aware of a small number of reports involving Spark drones that have lost power mid-flight. DJI says flight safety and product reliabilities are top priorities. Our engineers are thoroughly reviewing each customer case and working to address this matter urgently. DJI products are tested for thousands of hours, and the overwhelming number of customers enjoy using our products with minimal disruption. I like that, minimal disruption. But I think what The Verge is saying here is they take an interesting tack on this. They say that, you know what? All drones, when they're introduced, have a few problems here and there. They're not all perfect. They kind of draw an analogy to other electronic devices like phones, right? When a new model comes out, for most people, they're perfectly fine, no issues, but there are some strange things that happen for a small number of people. And I think in this article, The Verge seems to be saying it's the same thing here with DJI and the Spark. Here's something new. Yeah, a few of them are operating a little bit oddly, to say the least. But it's really no different than what happens with other drone manufacturers or other electronic devices.
And let's face it, they're not catching on fire like Android phones or something like that. But with any technology, you're going to have a good product or a bad product. You know, what's the old saying? You never buy a car that was built on a Monday or a Friday.
Well, I think that's a really, really good analogy. The other is software, right? If you go out, if something new comes out and you go out and purchase version 1.0, you're almost asking for issues.
You're expected to be a beta tester.
Basically, yeah. Now, I'm sure DJI fully intends when they release a new product like this for there to not be problems. But nevertheless, these are complex devices. There's a lot of hardware, a lot of electronics, a lot of software, increasingly more and more software, I think. And so, you know, the likelihood that there's going to be some kind of a bug or issue or something in there for some people in some conditions. And that's an interesting aspect of this as well, David, is we don't really know what the conditions are that surrounded each of these incidents. You know, I think the article points out there was one person who said that immediately before this happened, before the spark dropped, immediately prior to that, he had crashed it. So maybe there was something, some damage that was incurred. You know, DJI is going to have to investigate the circumstances surrounding each of these to try to figure out what's going on. And if even it's one thing that's going on, or if it's just a variety of things that cause this this behavior.
That's a really good point, that both you and I have done quality control in the past. You get an issue, you have to be able to diagnose it. Is it a one-off, or are you getting similar issues, but they're not, you know, sometimes it's very frustrating where you've got a bunch of issues that all look the same, but when you get down to it, they're not. It's the nature of electronics. It's the nature of insurance products like I do, or issues. Anytime you're dealing with any sort of system planning, eventually something breaks and you got to figure out if it's a one-off or it's a major issue. And I have no doubt that DJI is well on the ball with that.
I would think so. And hopefully if there is something that needs to be corrected, redesigned, fixed, whatever, hopefully it's something that can be addressed with firmware and not a hardware issue, because that would be a bigger difficulty for DJI.
Well, let's talk about AOPA, as this week is EAA, which is the Experimental Aircraft Association out in Wisconsin, otherwise known as Oshkosh. AOPA's been there. It's a big presence there every year. And this was from AOPA.org, from their UAV staff, and they're backing unmanned system standards, or TSOs, which are technical standard orders. You want to go a little deeper into what that means, Max?
Well, these TSOs, the technical standard orders, these particular ones that we're looking at here are meant to establish minimum standards that allow manned and unmanned aircraft to remain separated, safely separated. And so there's two draft TSOs. There's TSO C211 and C212. 211 is detect and avoid systems, and TSO C212 is air-to-air radar for traffic surveillance. And we'll put links to the actual TSO drafts, their PDFs. We'll put those in the show notes, and you can dive into those if you like.
And let's also emphasize that these aren't AOPA specs. This is AOPA endorsing FAA spec. These are specs created by the FAA. So yes, folks, we did get an FAA story in here, believe it or not. We just hit it well. But so AOPA is endorsing these standards, which is a good thing, because we always want the alphabet organizations to accept it, and it helps disseminate the information out. But these are FAA regs, or standards that will become standards. So check them out. And there's also a way, I believe, through the FAA to comment on and endorse and provide an endorsement, or you can do it through if you're an AOPA member. And we recommend that if you are a professional UAV pilot, you become a member of AOPA. So with that, I guess we should talk about your favorite video of the week.
I love this. I know, I think maybe a couple of people found this. Tim Trott did. And did you also find this video, David?
This came through our Twitter feed, and I tweeted it out on the UAV Digest Twitter feed with just the one word comment, wow. It's a very short video, but it's very impressive.
The title, we have an article from RT.com that talks about this. It's Soccer Fans Use Toilet Roll to Take Down Drone in Argentina. And we'll have, of course, the video, a link to the video in the show notes. You can actually play the video right from within the show notes. And it is short. And so what we have is a drone that is flying along the edge of the field, sort of parallel to the edge of the field, probably taking video of the fans in the stand. And one of them decides, well, I don't know what they decided, but or why they decided, but they...
But they got great aim.
They have great aim with this toilet paper roll that goes flying through the air and takes the drone. You know, one of the things that I found kind of surprising is this drone is amazingly vulnerable to toilet paper.
Toilet paper?
Yeah. I mean, that's not a very very robust defense if toilet paper can take you out.
Anytime you get anything tied up in rotor blades of various anything, you know, yeah. I mean, let's analyze this from the beginning. Whoever threw it had really good aim because he anticipated where it would be.
Yes.
So he threw the toilet paper in front of it so that when it hit, it landed square in the middle of all four rotors of this quad. Now, that impact jostles the quad, but in the meantime, the rotor blades start sucking up the toilet paper and unrolling the toilet paper and wrapping them around the rotor blades, causing the whole thing to just sort of drop from the sky right then and there. If you want an anti-drone system, this is a really good anti-drone system.
Evidently, it's
pretty cost-effective, because how much would a cost of toilet paper roll cost to take out your neighbor's drone?
Yeah.
Do not complete this at home or whatever we're supposed to say. This is for your own entertainment, but we do not recommend that you do this. So, and especially not even on Mischief Night, the night before Thanksgiving. So, but
this could be a great party game, you know, where if you're willing to sacrifice your drone, you know, in your backyard, give all of your friends over for the party a roll of toilet paper, and then try to dodge the rolls as they try to take your drone down. This could be great sport. Maybe this should be a new series, you know, the Take Down the Drone series or something.
Yeah, well, we you know, for every drone, there's an anti-drone, and this happened to be, your aim has to be really, really good.
Yeah.
This guy's aim was, from the stands, it's kind of one of those very impressive things, kind of like the lion that took it out, you know. I just wanted to know who was videotaping when it happened. You know, it was sort of like, they were videotaping the drone, and somebody... This wasn't planned. I guarantee you this was a spur-of-the-moment thing. So,
all right. Well, we've talked about the video of the week for much, much longer than the actual video of the week. And even though we've talked about it so much, it's still worth taking a look at. So, all right. Well, I think we should wrap this one up. We want to thank all of you for listening. As always, you can find us at theuavdigest.com. Our website has got some great show notes, links to all the articles, links to the documents that we reference. You can play videos right from our show notes. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's theuavdigest.com/204.
And of course, Max, you can find us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/theuavdigest, on Twitter at UAV Digest, And of course, we want you to become part of our Slack listener team, where you can find all sorts of inside jokes and really entertaining discussions about UAVs. And if you want, some airplane stuff too. So send us an invitation to feedback@theuavdigest.com and we'll send you an invite. It's quite important and quite entertaining. You can leave us some feedback at feedback@theuavdigest or on Stitcher, Google Play, and iTunes. You can buy some swag at our Cafe Press store or become a patron at account. Or I'm going to say something. You can find me September 27th and 28th in Toronto at the Big Drone Show. I will be going as a way to visit my family later in the week, but I will be there for both days. I'll be media credentialed. So if you're going to be at the Big Drone Show in Toronto at the end of September, send me an email at david@theuavdigest.com. I love meeting our listeners, and maybe we can hook up and set up maybe a quick meetup or go out and have a beer or something. So again, that's September 27th and 28th in Toronto, Ontario, at the Big Drone Show. So I guess with that little bit of news, I'm going to say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.